From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a moment many of us can understand. The loss of a parent. A young woman named Rebecca Sillick had lost her father. He was only 49 years old, and she lost him to cancer. And she kept hearing a similar refrain. Becky, he's in a better place now. And really, haven't we all heard that or maybe thought it at some point about a loved one? Becky was a deeply religious person, and her friends might have thought this sentiment would help. And it really didn't. With Father's Day approaching, we thought the story of her father is timely and appropriate. She's now Rebecca Renee Jones. She's the author of the new book, Broken for Good: How Grief Awoke My Greatest Hopes. It's the story about a journey of faith and the loss of her father that I think so many of us will relate to, and she can really write. Publishers Weekly says, quote, Jones is a sparkling new voice a la Anne Lamott with the rare ability to speak beauty in the midst of life's dark moments. So with Father's Day coming and with Book Week coming next week, it's kind of the unofficial start to Book Week on this Friday afternoon. Let me welcome Rebecca Renee Jones. Becky, it's great to see you. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful, and I'm so happy to be here.
Well, this is your first book, and you know, I should say I got to know Becky in your previous life when you were in doing some work for URMC, and but you transitioned as a mom to really focusing more on your writing. Did you expect this book to have an impact, to get a review like that in Publishers Weekly, to get some of the feedback you are? And I should also mention you can find Becky's book at Barnes & Noble and, of course, online. But did you expect this for this kind of a book?
I had hoped, but I wouldn't have said I expected it. You know, you write something and it's really personal and you hope other people can find themselves in it. And it's always a little surprising when they actually do.
And for a debut book, it is really personal. You're putting yourself out there. Your faith, the loss of your dad, what your family has gone through, a lot of very raw moments. And, you know, you have to hope that a community, a publishing community wants to embrace it, that a readership community wants to embrace it. It's a very raw and open place to start. And did you think about, you know, why did you choose to write this story for a first book?
You know, it's funny. I don't know that I chose to write it, as I couldn't not write it. I think once I went through this experience, and one of the reasons I really wanted the word awoke in the subtitle, I felt like I woke up. I felt like my life before that had been almost a kind of sleepwalk, you know, and suddenly I just had new eyes and I was seeing things and I was seeing, you know, brokenness in the world and pain and how pain can make people very lonely. And suddenly I wanted to be part of the change. And so I started writing this book, honestly, mostly for myself. I needed to process a lot of the emotions, a lot of the intellectual and faith questions. And so this was a bit of me trying to work out on paper what I understood and what I believe now. And, you know, at some point, the writing turned outward, and I realized I was writing to someone else. And that's when I kind of knew, and my mom was the one that read the manuscript, and she said, this book is going to get published. This is going to be your first book. And she's always been the champion of it.
And she was right. Now, I started with that notion that we've all heard that they're in a better place. You know, your father's in a better place now, or we've lost a parent, you've lost someone close to you. That's a really well-intended sentiment. I wouldn't be surprised if you've said it to people before. I've certainly probably said it and thought it. Why didn't it work for you hearing it?
It didn't work because I did believe it. I did believe he was in a better place, which was great for him. But being a little selfish, you know, we all are, I missed him. And so it was almost reminding me, he's in a better place, but you're not there yet. You know, you can't get to him right now. And so I think when they mean to encourage you, I think sometimes in grief we lose the fact that, and you'll hear people say it like, I won't go to that funeral because I didn't know that person. Well, you didn't know that person, but you know the person that's missing that person. And I think sometimes we almost forget that the sad part isn't for the one who's gone, it's for the people left behind. And so I think that's why that sentiment, you know, didn't sit right with me.
But it's supposed to be comforting, right? It's supposed to be comforting that you've lost your father far too young. And, you know, at least you can be comforted as a person of faith to think, you know, hey, you know, he's with God. I can feel good about that. And it still, for you, it kind of stung it still.
Yeah. You know, it was almost a foregone conclusion that, you know, he was going to be in heaven, you know, and that hopefully, you know, I will be in heaven someday, too. I have that hope. but it didn't change now, you know. And I think a lot of people think that faith changes a lot of emotions now, and it doesn't. It's not like it doesn't ease. You know, we still feel like the full circuitry of human emotion and human pain. And just because you have hope, it doesn't mean that you don't have many pains and heartaches in the world. You know.
But hold on, though. See, you say it was a foregone conclusion. You felt like, you know, you could be at least comforted with the idea that he would be with God. But I'm going to challenge you a little bit on that, because, you know, your father was not exactly like the rest of your family for many years. And we're going to get to that in just a second, because I thought it was very interesting for me to read about what Becky went through as a teenager growing up. And seeing your parents very different in their approach to faith. Mm-hmm. I think this is common in a lot of households. This is where I think mm-hmm. a lot of readers, even readers who are not, you know, strongly Christian or wouldn't identify the same way you do with faith, I think they'll relate to observing those interactions within a family. You know, when you've got two parents who maybe have different faiths, or at least different intensities of faith, or different approaches to sharing faith. I found that very interesting, and I want to get to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But let's take it back. Let's take it back to the lake.
Yeah.
You know, you open the book at the lake, and this is another scene that a lot of people will relate to. You love the lake. Your dad loved the lake.
Mm-hmm.
You started going there when? Tell me about that.
I mixed this part up. I was 14 or 15 when we bought the cottage, because we bought it at the tail end of one summer. So we had like a week there, and then we closed it up. And, you know, he had about four summers there. And the lake was just kind of this place that the family could be almost too close. If you've ever had a cottage, you know, you put the two sleeper sofas out on the lower level, and like your toes touched the people on the other couch's toes. And so it was a place that kind of threw us together, you know. And I don't know, for some reason, it's the one thing that hasn't changed all these years. My mom has since remarried, and she sold the house that, you know, we were last all in together. And so the lake is the one touchstone we all have. And so in many ways, it feels like the place, you know, where his memory lives.
You want to share where that is?
Yeah, it's a Lake Demon. It is such a tiny little lake that some maps call it Demon Lake, Demon Pond.
it's more, you know, of a big pond.
It's choose your own name, because it's so small, no one has really, you know, decided what it's called. But there are about 50 cottages on it, and you can water ski on it, but only three people can water ski on the lake at a time, and they have to go clockwise, and that's a real rule.
That was one of my favorite little details of the book. Becky's got a great eye for detail and for painting these pictures, and I read that and I went, that cannot be true.
It's true.
This little tiny lake, this oversized pond, only allows three water skiers at a time, and they have to be going clockwise.
It's very true.
That's funny.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny. And it's the kind, you said it's the kind of place where, you know, you could be out on the lake mm-hmm. and your mom could come outside and call everyone in for dinner. No mm-hmm. matter where you are on the lake, you're going to hear her.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty small. And I think, you know, when she puts her Benny Goodman jazz CD on the radio, the whole lake can hear it. So it's a very cozy little lake.
And you kind of loved the perfection of the imperfection, didn't
mm-hmm.
you? The peeling paint instead of the gleaming new paint jobs, the busted floorboard. You kind of, that became very homey for you, didn't it?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. It kind of, if you read through the book, maybe that's a motif, you know, finding perfection in the imperfection. You know, finding things that matter in the midst of, you know, like you said, peeling paint and the dock board that needs to be, you know, whacked down every summer because it's kind of come up and the nail's been loose. And I think this book really is, for me, it was about how do you find beauty and joy in a world that can break your heart, you know? And I think that's a theme. And the lake is, you know, it's not perfect, but nothing is, so.
Well, and I even would connect that to this theme that came later in the book, Burn the Candles, and we'll get to that.
Mm-hmm.
But this notion of, you know, for those of us who think perfection is just a museum-like existence, even Grove City, where Becky went to college, you know, there was that joking idea that there was a quad where no one was even allowed to step foot on it because the grass was too perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what kind of world are we living in where we can't step foot on grass?
Mm-hmm.
Or every little thing must be perfectly painted to be acceptable to us. Or, you know, you have a set of maybe a dishware or candles you just can't mm-hmm. use because they're too nice. And Becky's book does push you to think about those things. And in subtle ways, and I find that very interesting. Your father had those summers there, and for you, what's the image you remember most of that lake?
Yeah, pretty cool story. My sister's a photographer, and back when I was working with the book editorial team, kind of thinking of cover concepts, one of the ideas I always had was this picture of a cherry dad sat in towards the very end of his sickness. And I remember when, you know, it was in August, late afternoon, early evening, we had just kind of finished eating. And I remember I had to go and pick up a circular saw from the end of the dock because we'd been using it to repair the dock. And Mom had said, "Will you go pick it up? Because, you know, it's too heavy for Dad." And, you know, I'm thinking this thing that must be so heavy to lift, I'm going to go pick it up. And I was a strong kid. I was a pole vaulter in high school, and I was flattered by her request. And I got down to the edge of the dock to pick it up, and I saw Dad, and he was sitting in the chair, his back to me. And I just kind of watched him watching everything. And it was a moment that I realized he was saying goodbye. You know, he knew, I think somewhere deep inside him, that he didn't want to admit to all of us, but he knew this was his last trip down there. And that moment just, gosh, it just, I still think of it because there was something profoundly beautiful about how much he loved that place and how much he loved life. And so that was the picture I had always thought about when I thought of a book cover, you know, in my head, in my dreams. And when we went down to the lake last year, I told the editorial team, I said, you know, my sister's a photographer, if you want her to get any shots. And we ended up finding the old chair. And it's cool because it looks dilapidated, like, you know, like so many things. It has peeling paint. It was blue when we bought the cottage. Dad spray painted it red. Now it's red, blue, and rust. Yeah. And so my sister shot it. And it, I don't know, for me, it reminds me to take everything, good and bad, and, you know, soak it in.
For me, I look at that image and I read the story of who your father was and the story of loss and a journey of faith. And I think of the people in my life who are gone. I think we all can think of some place that they loved most. Doesn't have to be at the end of a dock at a cottage. Maybe it is. Maybe it's a chair in their house. Maybe it's a spot in your backyard, but a place that they loved so much. Mm-hmm. And that moment was really, really touching. When you went out to get the saw, and you kind of saw him almost trying to, as you say, drink in the entire lake, and mm-hmm. and he kind of knew. But I should also pull back a little bit and say that loss of your father to cancer, to melanoma, your mom came in at one point on, was it Independence Day, and told
yeah.
you? All right, so why don't you tell this story? And if you're just joining us, my guest is Rebecca Renee Jones. Her new book is called Broken for Good, How Grief Awoke My Greatest Hopes. You can find it at Barnes & Noble. You can find it online. Where can you find it, Becky?
Yeah, you can find it Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You know, here in Rochester, I think they have them stocked, so you could go get it today if you wanted to. You know, anywhere books are sold.
It's a beautiful story, I think, right in line with Father's Day. And with Father's Day coming, we'll talk about that a little bit later this hour with Becky and what that really means to her. I can guess, but I just thought it was timely. Rochester, we're doing Summer Book Week next week. I'll be off. Scott Feibusch will be here. And this is a nice lead into that. So the book essentially opens with that story of you being at the lake with your sisters. It's Independence Day. Your mom comes in to tell you. But before she told you, you could already kind of tell, couldn't you?
Yeah. Dad had been really, really grouchy that week. And she came up, and there's not really a door at the cottage, so she kind of knocked on the wall. And we were getting our swimsuits on and kind of putting sunscreen on. And our big goal that day was to lie down on the dock and, you know, drink iced tea or lemonade. And I could tell just by the look on her face. And her eyes, and before she even said it, I knew the cancer was back. He'd had cancer before, and thought everything was okay. It was skin cancer. Doctor said the mole was fine. Mole was not fine, and it spread, and eventually went to his stomach and some other places. But you know, it's funny because I look back at that moment, and yes, why I wrote a story about it. You know, I look back and there's so much metaphor in this, in what really happened, that it just lent itself to story. I mean, what day to realize that, you know, a kid's going to grow up and be independent. But, you know, July 4th is all, that's what that holiday is. It's about, you know, a kid growing up and going off on its own. And also just, you know, here we are putting on sunscreen and mom says this skin cancer's back. I mean, there's so much ridiculous irony when I think back to that moment. But, you know, the strange thing was, Dad really didn't want to talk about being sick. It was his way of coping. And so we really never talked about it almost the entire time he was sick. We never talked about it.
We're going back 15 years ago this summer that you got that news from your mother, right? And then mm-hmm. He passed away 14 years ago. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And I want to read a passage from that sort of experience of seeing him dying, but him not really acknowledging it. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, is what Becky does so well. The turns of phrase, when I say she can really write, I thought this was haunting and beautiful. And I just mm-hmm. want to read this. You write, quote, "It wasn't until he quit eating dinner with us that we knew, though no one spoke it. Dad took to a yogurt-only diet, and his doctor told us we could stop the shots. For months after he died, those unused boxes of interferon would sit in our refrigerator, thousands of dollars worth of medicine, keeping company with dill pickles." You know, that's an incredible image to think about. Beautifully but hauntingly said, but he really did kind of go through that where the only real acknowledgement on a daily basis was when you were helping administer the medicine at night, right?
Yeah. I would give him 5 clicks. It was like a pen syringe. So it was just like clicking a pen 5 times and that was it. And even then he didn't acknowledge it. He'd say, you know, "You did a good job tonight. That barely hurt, just a little prick." And it was like toothbrushing. You know, it was so routine. It was happening, but it wasn't happening. And that was almost the full extent that we talked about his sickness.
Did you want to talk more? I mean, that was just his style, huh?
Oh, yeah. I could talk. My mom says I can talk. So I was respecting what he wanted.
The book kind of moves in and out of some of these moments and pulls back in time a little. And at this point in the book, you move into a discussion of your father's faith. And I want to talk about that. Yours is a faithful Christian family, but for much of his life, your dad really wasn't. He taught at a Catholic school. Mm-hmm. He taught at a Catholic school, and you say he knew the routines, but he didn't really seem to kind of really buy them.
Yeah. I'm still confused by that, trying to understand his parents were deeply devoted, faithful people, and he was raised in the church. But for whatever reason, I really try to be really careful about writing this because no one can ever really know what's going on in someone's heart. And the last thing I want to do is try to understand what was going on in someone's heart or head. I don't want to delude myself to thinking I can know. But for whatever reason, from what I could see is, you know, we were hungry for God and knowing more about him. And it just, you know, there was a spiritual hunger that we felt as kids and that my mom felt. And we just didn't see the same thing in Dad. So, you know, for many years, I couldn't understand that. I couldn't understand how you could know who God was and is and not want more of him. You know, it just didn't make sense to my kid head and even to my adult head now.
And I want to read a passage as well from what Becky writes about seeing him, you know, even if he goes to church, you know, is that enough? This was a passage that, again, when I say this is a spiritual book, it really is. I mean, Becky wears her faith very proudly. But you don't have to be, again, a strong believing Christian to appreciate this sentiment and this question that comes up for a lot of people and a lot of families. And I'm going to quote from Becky's book now. Quote, "I believe the mere act of going to church on Sunday or Saturday or midweek on Wednesday evening is not a good enough litmus. Church attendance makes you a Christian about as much as pushing someone into a swimming pool christens them an Olympic freestyler, which is to say, warming a pew by itself is perfectly predictive of nothing except that you needed somewhere to sit." Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just a case of, "Hey, Dad, go to church with us."
No, it was, "Hey, Dad, I want you to taste what I'm tasting. You know, I want you to know what I know. I want you to feel what I'm feeling. It was like if you meet someone, you're so excited to know them and you want to introduce them to everyone. You know, I wanted Dad to know and experience God like I was knowing and experiencing God, and I couldn't understand why that didn't seem important. That said, there were subtle hints and little clues, you know, when I look back through my childhood, and this was one of the actually more recent passages that I wrote, and my editor really pushed me to explore this, because in the earlier manuscript, she had said, you know, I get this sense that there's a little bit of a disconnect in your spiritual journeys, yours and your dad's, and could you explore that? Because I think a lot of people can relate. And so I was terrified, thinking, oh goodness, how do I write about the one thing we never talked about or we avoided talking about? And also, how do I do it in a way that's respectful to him? You know, not being able to have that conversation of, well, why, Dad? So going back, I really tried to honestly look at things I remember, concrete things. And one of the things I remember is when he would tuck me in at night, he would do the shape of the cross on my forehead. And he'd say, I bless you in the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. And there were little things like that where I knew that there was still something he wanted from God. And, you know, we just didn't have a good chance. There's so much that fathers and daughters don't say. There's so much of that relationship that is unspoken. And I look forward to someday really getting to get to the bottom of what was going on and not going on with him.
Sure. And I think, again, what you say there, that's a lot of people relate to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I certainly took the point from your book that, you know, this is cliche, but I'll just put it this way. Mm-hmm. Say it now, or, you know, discussing it. It's not always easy, but it's worth mm-hmm. exploring. What do you remember him saying when the question of, you know, when you guys would go to church, for example, or when you guys would talk about spiritual aspects, what do you remember him saying?
Well, Dad was a jokester, and he was a musician. He was an entertainer. So everything was a game or a joke, and he used humor. You know, so many people used humor to avoid conversations that they don't want to be having. So he would joke around, or he'd just say that I'm busy, or he'd read the swap sheet, or he'd just Raisin Bran. And at some point, we just stopped asking, because we kind of knew what the answer would be. But he would, you know, he would come on Easter and Christmas.
That's the, by the way, I the term CNE Christians or CEO Christians, Christian and Easter only, or, yeah. or Christmas and Easter only.
Yeah.
So he was a CEO Christian.
Yeah. And I would get so mad because the people in the pew behind us would be so excited to see, you know, a man sitting with us that they'd shake his hand and they would shake it so hard. I would be so angry. I'm like, they're scaring him away. Those crazy people. but, you know, I think they were genuinely just excited to see him. But, you know, I think we don't know all the reasons people believe or don't believe. I think there are a lot of reasons we give, and there are a lot of like intellectual reasons, and there are a lot of emotional reasons, and there are a lot of reasons we don't even admit to ourselves. I think it's an extremely personal thing. And
how much do you wish now for more time to at least? Well, you say you're going to have that time. I know you're confident you will. How much do you wish you would have when he was here?
You know, I don't really wish or regret, because I think things all happen the way they were meant to happen. And, you know, looking back, and I didn't write about it in the book because I kind of remembered it actually after. But there was one note I sent him when he went to the hospital for an earlier surgery, when they thought, you know, before he started the medicine. And I wrote a long note, and I don't remember what I said, and even going through his things, I never found it. He told me thank you for the note, but it was a note where I pretty much said everything that I had never said before. But again, I don't remember what was said. I just remember feeling very nervous to give it to him. So I think I said what I needed to say, but I never really got feedback.
Mm-hmm. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back with Rebecca Renee Jones talking about her new book, Broken for Good, How Grief Awoke My Greatest Hopes. It's the story of the loss of her father, what it awakened in her, and the story of a journey of faith in many ways. And in advance of Father's Day, we thought it was an appropriate and timely conversation. The book is new. She's a first-time author. She's getting a lot of praise for this book. It's really beautifully written and very touching in many ways. And I've been sort of stressing the point. Your faith background, I think, I'm sure you have a lot of Christian readers, but I suspect you're going to have a lot of people who are not necessarily in that exact same vein of faith who can relate to a lot of the themes. And I know that was important to you, right?
It was extremely important. I said, grief touches everyone. I didn't want this to be a book that could only hurt, you know, only help certain people who believed what I believed.
You can find the book now at Barnes & Noble and online, or wherever books are sold online, as we say. But let's get our only break, and we're going to come back, and I want to explore a kind of a desperation Becky felt as her father was dying, and some of the things she writes in the book about that I want to ask about. That's next on Connections. And Monday on Connections, we kick off our annual Summer Books Week. Scott Feibusch is hosting an entire week of shows dedicated to books, writing, publishing, the industry, and more. In our first half hour Monday, they're going to talk about the debate over the MFA. Does it open doors, or does it hold writers back in their efforts to be published? Then in our second hour, we'll talk with author Andy Babiuk about his book, Beatles Gear, all the Fab Four's instruments from stage to studio. And for a preview of the entire book week, visit WXXINews.org and scroll down to the Summer Books Week section. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I should have said earlier, Happy Father's Day to Becky, because they've got a four-year-old as of today. Mm-hmm. So Happy Father's Day to your husband, and Happy Father's Day in the spirit of this book and thinking about your dad. So mm-hmm. I just want to say that and get that out of the way. And happy birthday to your son today.
Yeah, thank you.
We both have four-year-olds now.
Mm-hmm.
It's wild, isn't it?
Crazy.
It is a remarkable age. Becky's book is Broken for Good, and so you're getting a sense for the difference that Becky felt when her father was dying, and looking at his approach to God and the difference between Becky's dad and essentially the rest of their immediate family. You were 17 at the time, right? 17, mm-hmm. turning 18. And I want to kind of go to that section where you wrote about being on a bike was sort of a place of prayer for you.
Yeah.
And what you wrote here, I want to read this and get more of a sense for what you meant by it, if we could here. Because mm-hmm. you were out on a bike ride, and can you kind of set the scene if you remember the section I'm talking about here? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think, and I remember so much of this because I have a journal that was incredibly helpful when I was going to write this.
I would say so. That journal probably came in very handy.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. It did. And I remember we just had a conversation with the doctor where they said, I remember 6, 12, 18. He is 6, 12, or 18 months. And I remember thinking, 6 months? No, it actually was 2 months.
Wow.
We didn't know that at the time. But those numbers they felt so urgent. You know, we're all going to die someday, but you know, when you're given a number, it's sobering. And so I'd gotten on my bike, and it's just kind of my way of getting away from family and thinking and praying. I was biking and just feeling a sense of urgency. You know, all the conversations that we had had and the conversations we danced around and time running out and just wondering what I was supposed to do.
So can I read from that? I want to ask you a little bit more about what you meant there. You write that you wanted to lay it out. You wrote, "This feels hopeless, and so that afternoon, as the wind rustles fields, shakes the corn, tosses wheat, I bend my head too. Right there on my bike, I tell God, okay, here's the deal. And I lay it all out. I am willing, I say. Then I pause for impact, and I go ahead and tell God, I am willing to give him up now if it means I'll get him forever." What do you mean by that?
Well, at that point, I really didn't know, you know, if he had made a peace with God. And I was waiting for some kind of assurance, you know. You know, my hope is, and what the Bible says, and is that if we accept that Jesus died for our sins on the cross as a gift, if we accept that gift, he'll give us heaven. And I hadn't heard that language come out of Dad's mouth.
So you were scared for his eternal soul, weren't you?
Yeah, because I loved him. I loved him so much. You know, I wanted to be with God, and I want him to be with God. And I wanted that for him. And I so sincerely believed it, and I still do. And you know, that was my ache for him. And I told God, you know, for a long time I've been praying, you know, for him to be healed. And that was kind of the moment I shifted my weight. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to stop. Not that I'm going to stop praying for his healing, but I just, God, I trust you. And if this is your way of drawing Dad to you, then I trust it. It was kind of a letting go prayer. And I really did hang my head on my bike. And I'm a really bad biker, so that was not a smart thing to do. But yeah, it was a hard thing to write, and it was a harder thing to live.
So let me now then come at this from the angle that I think our non-Christian listeners may come at.
Sure.
Because I think a lot of people will read that, and they will ache for a 17, 18-year-old girl worried about her father's soul, wanting her father to connect with God the way you did. And they'll admire you for just, you know, thinking about him and thinking about eternity that way. I think some less religious listeners may think, you know, did you ever think, you know, who am I to think, to judge my father and to think about his soul and, you know, that his version of God is not good enough or not enough? Right. I mean, this was a dad who made the sign of the cross on you at night and didn't go to church with you. But, you know, did you worry that it was presumptuous to think, I'm 17, I'm 18, I know what eternity holds for my dad?
You know, if you could feel the raw, like how raw and sincere that ache was, it didn't feel presumptuous at all, if that makes sense. It didn't feel like I was judging him. He was a great man. You know, I wasn't judging his character. I was just going on the information I have. And, you know, when you believe something so hard, you don't keep one foot in and one foot out. You believe it, you know? And so it didn't feel presumptuous. I just, I sincerely believe it, and I ache for him.
I actually think that's very intellectually consistent, to be honest with you. And I think then the follow-up that some of the less Christian or non-Christian listeners would have is, you know, why don't we see people of your level of faith proselytizing even more? Because I know you love your father.
Right.
And you're thinking about eternity and him, and you want to be with him in eternity.
Right.
But you also have got friends, you've got acquaintances, you've got people you don't know, but you want good things. You want eternity for them, too. Right. Why aren't you proselytizing, right, you know, more?
Well, the book is a first step.
In a sense, the book is.
Hopefully it's a soft step. You know, it's a really great question. I often wonder that if we really believe what we really believe, why don't we believe it a little more loudly? I think, you know, it's such a personal thing. And, you know, in the case of Dad, I knew he knew everything. It was a matter of his will, I think, at the end of the day, saying, you know what, because in those last couple of days before he died, he and my mom had a conversation, and every bit of the language he'd heard from us or, you know, church over the years came right back. It was all tucked away. He was just waiting to say yes. And so I knew it wasn't an intellectual thing for him. It was just him being ready to say yes. And to that gift. And, you know, the interesting thing is, I do really wonder why we're not more vocal. I think for me and Dad, I can say at least in the space of that relationship, I knew he knew all the language. I knew he knew the words. I knew he knew the story. He'd been raised in it. Hopefully we've been living it out as an example to him, what we believed. But at the end of the day, I didn't want to push him away. You know, I didn't want to push him into anything. And I said it felt very much like trying to, I think I talk about like trying to catch a rabbit. You know, you almost want to sneak up on it. You don't want to startle it. And I felt very much like I had to be careful. And I feel that sometimes in my friendships and with certain family members even now and, you know, colleagues, you don't want to push someone away. And so you don't say anything. And actually, that's how we treat grief too. You know, let's be honest, we don't want to offend, so we say nothing. Even though it's the most important things. I find that the most important things get talked about less. And I don't think it's just faith. I think it's, you know, it's people don't talk about money.
I agree.
Grief.
I agree.
Faith.
Agree. And I think that's got to change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not just talking about faith either. I think in general, we try to stay no third rails on this show.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about anything and we'll try to do it respectfully. But I agree with you. And I admire that in you. You know, I think the book is very much a representation of how you feel. I have great admiration for that. And I think I think it's a love note to your father, and it is it's a testament to your faith and the journey of faith. You mentioned him saying yes.
Yeah.
How did you find out about that?
Yeah. So I had gone home. I don't remember if it was to take a shower or to do what, but he had been in hospice this last week, and I had gone home. And it's funny, in that journal, it's actually a journal where I write letters. Kind of a prayer journal, I'd call it, but more like just letters to God, because, you know, I need to write to someone. And one of the things I had written was, you know, I just sensed something different in Dad. There was a piece that he had the last couple of weeks that was so different than a lot of the anger he'd had before. I've never seen someone so different. And there was just a peace that he exuded right down to his tone of voice. And I sensed something was different. I sensed something had changed, but I wasn't sure what. And so I'd written down that morning, I'd said, God, I sensed something different in Dad. I need you to affirm it some way. And that night, Mom called me from the hospital, and she said, you know, I sat with your dad, and he told me that he's accepted Christ as his Savior, and he just wanted us to know that. And that came the same day I had written out, you know, that prayer letter. So it was special, because those were words I'd ached to hear for as long as I can remember. And I almost dropped the phone.
I know now that there has to be comfort there. Have you thought about if you hadn't known? Because I think you make an important point in the book that you got to be very careful about thinking you really know what's in someone's heart.
Yeah.
And I'll also just pull back and say, I think, like I called the book a love note to your dad in a way, but it's also very real. Becky writes in a way that is very honest. And by that, I mean, it's not hagiography. You're not trying to paint a picture of your father that he's the greatest person who's ever lived and that no one who met him would think otherwise. You're trying to paint a picture of a loving, good man who had, you know, character traits, you know, funny quirks, a sense of humor, occasionally would mock certain things. And I thought it was very real. I always think that makes it much more real.
It sounds like you've met him.
Well, I feel like in your book I have. But, having written narrative nonfiction a good amount myself, occasionally you'll write about subjects, especially the still living. I will tell you this, they want hagiography.
Oh, yeah.
And that's not real, you know. So I admire that. But when it comes to faith, you're very careful about saying, you know, we can't always know what's in someone's heart. We shouldn't presume we know what's in someone's heart. Had you not gotten that message from your mom, your father might have felt that way and taken that to his grave with him. And you wouldn't have known that. And I wonder if you think that you would feel differently about everything.
Gosh, it's hard to go back and imagine a story different. I honestly don't know, Evan. It would be a very different book. All I know is this was my longest running prayer request. I love Dad so much. And when you really believe it, like, I wanted that assurance from him. Gosh, I hope it doesn't sound judgmental at all, because that's not the way I mean it at all. But when you really believe something, you really believe it, you know? So, yeah, that story could have been very different. And honestly, I set off to school. I was a freshman entering my freshman year at Grove City College. I drove down to Pennsylvania 3 days before he died and, you know, came home hours before he died. We didn't know how quick it would go. And honestly, I was a selfish little freshman who wanted to go to the graffiti dance for freshmen. And so I drove down to school, and then my aunts came and drove me back and got to say that final goodbye, give him a final kiss. But the story would have been different.
Again, that's why I admire Becky and have known her for a number of years and admire that so much. Some of our listeners on Twitter said, remind us what the book is. The book is Broken for Good, How Grief Awoke My Greatest Hopes by Rebecca Renee Jones. She's my guest for the hour. The book is out now. You can find it at Barnes & Noble, You can find it online. And Father's Day's coming. What does it mean to you now, you know, 14 years after losing your dad? Does it, you know, you actually said, I'm not going to repeat what you said earlier before the hour got going when we were talking about certain things, but you're clearly at a peace enough that you can occasionally joke or you think about him, and it's not all grief, which is great. But what does Father's Day mean to you?
You know, I will tell you a story, and I resisted using this to end the book because it felt like a little blue ribbon. It felt like putting a little ribbon on top of a book, and I hate that in a memoir because it's not a Disney movie. But 4 years ago, I was very pregnant. I was a week overdue, and actually Morgan had just had, you guys had just had your baby a few weeks before, I think.
A couple of months before,
And I think on Facebook you told me to just be patient, right? Which I didn't appreciate that at the moment.
well, we went to about 43 weeks, so, you know.
Yeah.
That's patience.
She's a saint. Yes, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that is true.
Oh, so I'm very, you know, very, very pregnant. And I had always made this promise, you know, my husband and I had this agreement. Once we found out that our little boy was going to be a boy from the ultrasound, I knew I was going to name him after my dad. So Patrick is named for his grandpa. And isn't it cool? He was born 1 week late, which happened to be my husband and my 6-year anniversary. And it also happened to be Father's Day. So he's named for my dad, born on Father's Day, which, you know, so you ask what Father's Day means now. It means so many things. It's just family. It's just this moment that as busy as you get, and goodness, we've been so busy this week. It reminds me, slow down, look what matters, look who's here, you know? That's hopefully we do that every day, but it's one day where I can't forget how lucky I am.
Yeah, it's multi-generations in your family. Well, you open the book with a look at your view of God's hand in creation. In everything. Was there, I wish I would have flagged this one. I think you mentioned dinosaurs, brontosaurus. What was that line? It was so good.
I think I was referring to brontosauri, what's the plural? But rolling their necks out like they're Play-Doh or something.
Hold on. This is so good. He plants redwoods, evergreens, hangs high the North Star, fastens tissuey wings on buzzing green beetles, then whiskers on kittens. Slowly he stretches brontosauri necks strong, long, like he's rolling soft pretzels. I love that. Yeah.
I couldn't remember.
You had to go back and think about the phrase
material,
you used. Yes.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And I will just tell you, the farther you get from your moment of creation for this book, you're going to go, I wrote that? It's amazing. I love that line. But I want to ask you as well, as a person of faith.
Yeah.
Do you ask yourself, if God did all that, why did you make cancer? Why did you make childhood illness?
Yeah.
Why did you make poverty?
Right. I think, you know, these are huge questions.
Yeah.
One thing I will say about grief and pain is it doesn't give you every answer, but it gives you all the right questions. Questions like, if God exists, then why this? If God's good, then why this? You know, does he care? Is he strong? Is he strong and doesn't care? I think that grief, for me, sent me on a search for things I knew intellectually but didn't know by the heart. And those were some of the questions that you do wrestle with. I do think there's this little thing called sin. I think sin screws things up. I really believe that. And I think a lot of the pain, things like cancer, I don't think they were originally intended as part of the game plan. I think they're the unfortunate consequence of sin, original sin. That said, there are lots of questions that I don't have answers to. And that's where the faith part comes in. I believe in a God that's bigger than me, a God that's smarter than me. And so I believe there are some questions that have answers that are beyond my pay grade. I don't mean that to sound like a cop-out. I just, at some point, you have to believe that if you believe in a God that's bigger than you, he's going to know things you don't.
See, I think it's a total cop-out, and I think it's totally fair.
Yeah,
no,
I know.
It's
one of those hard things.
It's not a cop-out. I just think I think the question, though, is a fair one.
Right.
And I think it's one that we should be thinking about when we evaluate, You know, do we believe this? Do you believe in God? And do we believe in an omniscient, omnipotent God who has laid dominoes out? You talk about a plan for things. So I think those are fair questions.
Yeah. No, I think they are. And I think for me, like I said, I felt very, like that word awake keeps coming to mind. I felt like up until this point, I had been sleepwalking. I still believed all the same things. I just, suddenly I was really struggling. I used this analogy, and there's a line that got cut from the book, and I wish it hadn't because I loved it so much. But it's this idea that I had this pretty little faith, and suddenly someone shoved her in the deep end and forced her to swim. You know, she was forced to tread water. I learned how faith worked. And so I don't know. There are these hard questions, and I still, you know, I get books out of the library about them. I have a, if you could see my bookshop at home, I am asking all these same questions still. I think there are answers. I don't know, like it or not, I don't know that I'm going to get every answer right now.
I think it's totally hard. Fair, by the way.
That's hard.
I think it's totally fair.
It's hard, though.
Yeah.
I don't like it either.
Well, before we lose the hour, Becky, can you tell me about burning the candles?
Yeah. So I'm thinking, how do you end this book? And really, my mom gave me the perfect analogy. And it's not even an analogy because it's a true story. My grandma was sick with cancer. My mom is amazing. She lost both her parents a month apart, and then my dad 4 years later. And so she was with my grandma. My grandma had cancer. My grandma and my mom both knew it was grandma's last Christmas, but again, they weren't saying it. And so my mom was over at grandma's house, and she was getting Christmas Eve already, and you know, getting appetizers in and out of the oven, and the last presents under the tree, and grandma had this beautiful sculptural glittery candle on the coffee table, and mom had leaned down to light it, and my grandma said, "Lori, not that one, like not that candle. It's, you know, everyone has that candle that the wick is still unburnt every single Christmas." And my mom looked at my grandma and she said, "What are you waiting for?" And my mom told me that story the first Christmas Dad had died, and my mom was lighting a pretty candle of her own. And it's a phrase that she and I have come to say in those moments where we're being too precious, we're being stupid, we're holding a grudge, we're getting angry, we're worried about wasting something on something that's not worth it. And she and I say, "Burn your candles." And it's just this reminder that we're here now. And so a lot of people think the gift, you know, grief has a gift, and that's one of the messages I hope that comes out of this. It takes a long time sometimes to realize it, but the gift of grief is this perspective that we're not going to live forever, so let's live now. And I hope that's a message that comes out of this book.
This is so interesting because burn your candles. Mm-hmm. You know, that sentiment for you is a very Christian one. That for you, the greater world is to come.
Mm-hmm.
Burn your damn candles.
Yeah, I mean, don't be precious about it.
You can't take that with you from this world.
Yeah.
You know, drink your good bottle of wine. Burn your candles.
Exactly.
You know,
drink
run
the
on
good
the
wine.
Grass. You know what I mean? For you, it's a very Christian sentiment. For others, though, for an atheist, that could be a similarly valuable sentiment.
YOLO, right.
Yeah, you know, and I actually found some real beauty and the significance of that message that may parallel across faiths or even for non-believers. Mm-hmm. I just thought that was, and I didn't think it was precious at all. I thought, I really appreciated that. But you just touched on this. You said you'll never, of course, say that you're happy your father died.
No.
But you're thankful for this experience. And maybe that's a good way, in a minute or so, encapsulate why you use the word thankful.
Yeah. Well, here's a big profound thing that I didn't realize until I was writing this is you can be thankful for which you're not actually, for things that don't actually make you happy. And I think for me, it was, Dad taught me so much by going. I was 18 and I was spreading my wings wide and I thought I was going to go do things in the world. And, you know, he taught me, you don't get to hear the big eulogies. You know, you don't get to hear all the wonderful things people say about you. And, you know, he helped me break up with this idea that, you know, I was going to find all my happiness in this world and I was going to find it through approval. Because I still sort of believe that on some level. But he taught me to honestly look further. It's something you believe as a person of faith, but until this world really breaks your heart, it's hard to get excited about another world.
You're a wonderful writer. Real briefly, people can find more. You've done some blogging. You occasionally mm-hmm. write more than just a book here. Mm-hmm. Where can they find more of you, Becky?
Rebecca Renee Jones, it's R-E-N-E Jones, mm-hmm. .com is kind of my web outpost. And so that's probably the best place to go.
RebeccaReneeJones.com, Renee, R-E-N-E. Mm-hmm. The book is called Broken for Good, How Grief Awoke My Greatest Hopes. I think anyone who's has a dad or lost a dad or will relate to it.
It covers just about everyone.
It covers just about all of us. We'll find real beauty there. And 30 seconds, what are you going to do next? Next book?
Oh, I'm working on a fiction project, but it's not cooperating.
The fiction project is not cooperating?
Yeah, it's not cooperating.
Those projects, they're so tough, aren't they?
They are. They're very fiddly.
Well, they're fiddly like toddlers who are also mm-hmm. occupying a lot of your time.
Yeah.
Again,
yeah. Well, one toddler, but yes.
Again, happy birthday to Patrick.
Thank you.
And good luck to you. But the book is, you know, it's eye-opening, and I thought it was a perfect way to lead into Father's Day. So thank you for coming in and sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca Renee Jones, RebeccaReneeJones.com. Reminder, listeners, next week is book week. I'm off. Scott Feibusch is hosting the program. And Scott Feibusch and Megan Mack have put together a wonderful week. Generally speaking, the first hours next week, you're going to have sort of industry discussions, that kind of thing. Second hours, you'll have author interviews. It'll be a great week. And a preview of the entire week, go to WXXINews.org, scroll down to the Summer Book Week section. I think we just sort of kicked it off early with Rebecca Renee Jones. Thanks, John Andrus, the engineer of this broadcast. Megan Mack is the outstanding producer who makes the show work. I'm Evan Dawson, and I will talk with you two Mondays from now.